All right. Thank you, Steve. You're not permitted to leave the room. I'm just kidding. You can leave the room. So we're going to jump into our first topic. Thank you very much for returning. We appreciate that. Yes, I think so. Did it go on? Yeah, it's on. Hello, hello. Okay, I think it's there. All right, so the first thing we wanted to jump into was the various ways in which the state of Colorado has attempted to address the presidential caucus issue from this last spring. There have been a couple of different, here, I'll make you look at the full screen. There have been a couple of legislative options that were floated in the House and Senate this last year that both failed. And now we have a citizen initiative to change the Colorado Constitution to institute a primary. That's right, it's statutory, to change us to a primary. And they all have different elements to them. They're all they have very specific changes that they would make. So we wanted to kind of go through those and talk about the different ways in which this issue has been addressed legislatively, and then kind of open it up to all of you to discuss what other options or ideas that you may have, or ways that we can institute a policy that everybody's comfortable with. So, yes.
I mean, I guess I welcome the education in terms of what the proposals have read all those. But the proposal that to me would be more interesting to have a discussion around what could be right now, mm-hmm. and that's the initiative. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? And then how, as a group, can we support what do we have to do with change?
Absolutely. And so the third one, so I go through each one. And so the third one is includes the details of the initiative, which you're right, is at this point the most likely one to occur, at least certainly this year, if it makes the ballot, and then people vote on it. So, but let me kind of tell you about our history. So prior to 1992, we had a caucus system. From 1992 to 2000, we did presidential primaries, and then the primary was repealed in 2003, and we've had caucus in 2004, 8, 12, and then again in this last year. So the first bill that came up this year was Senate Bill 216. By the way, in your packet, I have a copy of 216. I also have a copy of House Bill 1452 or 1454.
House Bill was first.
Was it the House Bill first one? Yeah. So the two options are in there. And then you'll also see the language from the two initiatives. There's one initiative that's a presidential primary, and then there's the state primary initiative as well. So this one has some pretty interesting elements, and then a lot of things which are very similar to the House bill. The timing elements of this are that a date would be designated by the governor in consultation with the Secretary of State. It will be picked by September 1 of the previous year, no earlier than the national party rules permit, and no later than the third Tuesday in March. Assuming that those two things jive, I suppose that it's possible that in the future they wouldn't. And not less than 14 days after the precinct caucus. So those are the major timing constraints of Senate Bill 216. The ballots would be specific to the voter's political party. So if you were affiliated, you would get a ballot that was from that party. Voters can only vote for candidates within their party ID. Unaffiliated voters could declare a party and vote. So you could declare either ahead of the mailing of ballots and thus become a member of that party, and get the ballot, or you could declare that you wanted to change your party at a polling place, and that there can be only the presidential primary on the ballot. No other races were permitted on the ballot. A majority vote of the party central committee could decide not to hold the primary. And ballot access would be kind of the typical party process. That is how the party's identified candidates. They are the sort of overriding national ways in which parties identify presidential candidates. Then candidates, you could be a candidate that could get 1,500 affiliated signatures in each congressional district. So we have 7 congressional districts, 1,500 affiliated signatures in each. Candidate petitions could be circulated from November 1 to January 2nd. And the Secretary of State's office certifies the names to the ballot 60 days prior to the primary. It's a mail ballot election, just like all of our other elections. We send you a ballot. That doesn't mean you need to vote it. You can bring it in. You could vote on DRE, or you could submit it by dropping it off or putting it back in the mail. And the funding, the money would come from the general fund. Counties would be reimbursed for costs. It's kind of, it doesn't go into a lot of detail about what that is, but it does say that the Secretary of State's office will determine the calculation for reimbursement. So the counties would become very friendly with the Secretary of State's office. So that is Senate Bill 216. This is House Bill 1454. You'll hear that a lot of it's similar, but a couple of things are a little bit different. Again, the date designated by the governor in consultation with the secretary. Again, it's picked by September 1. The national rules apply. It has to be done by the third Tuesday and not less than 14 days after the caucus. So those things are all the same. Ballots will be specific to the voter's party. Voters can only vote for candidates within their party. And then the state party chairperson can add a no preference. So this is slightly different in the House bill. They also created in the House bill a temporary affiliated elector. This has several very interesting provisions. Persons who wish to become affiliated with a party can do so on a temporary basis. This goes into effect January 1 of 2018. You can declare a new temporary party up to 45 days before the primary. The affiliation automatically terminates 30 days after the primary. A voter cannot change twice within the 29 days prior to an election. And online voter registration and forms have to be changed to correspond to create this sort of measure within the ways in which the public makes changes. Ballot access, again, very similar. Party process, candidates has to get 1,500 affiliated voters from each congressional district. Candidate petitions circulated between November and January. The SOS certifies the name 60 days prior to the primary. So all the same, mail ballot applies. The funding, the money comes from the general fund. Counties reimburse for costs, and the SOS determines calculation for reimbursement. So a lot of it's the same. It's just that temporary affiliated elector, which is the main difference. And that brings us to number 140, which is the ballot initiative. If it gets on the ballot, so if they submit the signatures, we review the signatures, they get 98,452, then it's on the ballot, and at that point, it will get a real number. Right now, it's just got the number, so don't get attached to 140. That may change in the future. So 140 is very different. It creates a combined ballot for presidential primary elections. The timing, the date is designated by the governor. There's no consultation with the Secretary of State. Apparently, you're unimportant in that process. It must be picked by September 1. Again, no earlier than the national party rules permit, third Tuesday in March. And the SOS may cancel the election 60 days prior with no opposition. So if for whatever reason a party said, hey, look, we're we've already decided this, we've got one candidate, they tell us and then we can cancel. Party ID. Affiliated voters may not switch parties inside 29 days prior to the election. So that means, I suspect, that they don't want party switching at the last minute. So switching from an uninteresting race to a more interesting race just to be able to vote in that race. And that's where we're going. Party access. Again, our ballot access, the party has their process. This is a little different here. Candidates pay $500 or obtain 5,000 signatures from an affiliated voter. Let me tell you, we're probably going to get a lot more people who are going to pay that $500 and just get their name on the ballot. Nobody's going to go for 5,000 affiliated voters if they can pay $500. It's hard to get 5,000 people to sign a petition. Candidate petition circulated again November 1 to January 2nd, and SOS certifies 60 days prior. And then we get to the ballot. So this is significantly different. The ballot only has presidential primary like we had before. Affiliated voters vote the party ID or party ballot. Unaffiliated voters can declare a party at the VSPC and receive that party's ballot. Right? Or they can receive a combined mail ballot, which has all the candidates for all offices broken down by parties, and it's organized by parties. They'll get the ballot. Well, the or is if you declared or if you registered to vote and you registered as an unaffiliated at a VSPC, we're not going to mail you a ballot at that point. You're at that point going to need to say, hey, I'm unaffiliated, but right now I declare myself a Republican so I can get the Republican ballot. So they could be different. Sure. They will automatically be mailed a ballot, and it would be a combined ballot. Mm-hmm. This would also, it's unclear to me, although my interpretation, I think the office's interpretation is that if you had a competitive race for Libertarian or for American Constitutional Party or for Green or any other party, they could also be on that ballot if they chose to be, because they have a way of opting out of, they can close, if you look at number 10, a minor party can close their primary if they so choose. It doesn't say what happens if they don't so choose. My interpretation of it is they would also be on the combined ballot. So they qualify. Yeah. So, and it is based on party rules. So that's a very good point. The ballots will then clearly distinguish that it's this part is the Republican part of the ballot, and this part is the Democratic part of the ballot, and this potentially could be the Libertarian part of the ballot. And you may only vote for candidates within that section of the ballot. If you start voting for a Republican and then you vote for a Democrat I vote for, Ted Cruz and I vote for Bernie Sanders, well, then that ballot is void. And the state party chair can add a no preference. 75% of the party's central committee can forego the primary with a vote. And as I mentioned, a minor party can choose a closed primary where unaffiliateds would not be able to vote. So that's the pretty significant change in the way that the ballot themselves would work, both in, how a person would access the ballot and then what would be on the ballot. Funding, this is a significant change. Money comes from the SOS cash fund, unless we have exhausted that cash fund, and then it would come through an appropriation by the JBC.
So what that means is that we would, under this, we would spend all of the money we have to cover the cost, and then we would hope the JBC gives us money for the general election so we can actually run a general election in the fall. That's one way. That's the way it's worded. Or the Secretary of State adds a presidential primary surcharge onto something to cover and build up the cost for it. So that's the fun of this particular proposal.
So there's no reason why the legislature cannot go in and upgrade that $500 fee, right, to $50,000, for example, for a presidential primary person to have access to the ballot. Right?
Well, it is a legislative measure, and so yeah,
there's a time frame during which they can't change it.
Right.
But once that time frame passes, they could. Mm-hmm. But whether it's 500 or 50,000, it won't come anywhere near covering the cost of it. So you've still got the issue of do we add a surcharge to businesses or nonprofits to cover this, or do I just not fund the general election?
So it also then has this very interesting little caveat that the counties are reimbursed under 15505.5, which is the current reimbursement statute, but only for active voters who vote. So
the counties are really funding this.
So right, the counties are really funding it because our reimbursement percentage would go down by at least a third or maybe a quarter. Because right now we reimburse for all active voters, because frankly, the expense of the election from a county perspective is a big chunk of it is the materials you're sending out in the mail. You know, it's a mail ballot, it's going out, and all the postage associated with that. But this would remove that for those people who do not vote. So if you had a high turnout election, you're going to get a high reimbursement from the state, which would come close to covering those expenses. If you had a low turnout election, it would be a much lower reimbursement. You have a different interpretation.
I'm shaking my head no, because the 80 cents a voter for a large county,
yeah, of course,
and the 90 cents for the smaller counties does not come remotely close to covering the cost of the election. It covers about a third normally, but if you then cut it to say only those who actually vote. So if you look at the 20% turnout we had in the last, you get 20% of the money you normally would. So, yeah, the counties are going to cover the whole cost, basically.
So, and then the last thing, which was interesting, is that the party caucus, the law would move the party caucus from February to the Saturday following the primary. So that was also an interesting addition.
And so I look at the two party reps here. That means when you're trying to get your caucus locations, you can't begin that, you can't complete that process until the governor sets the date, which might be 4 months before. So for those of you who've dealt with your parties who have struggled to find caucus locations, and I think of, you know, the high turnout we had at some of the Democratic caucuses this time, this significantly complicates that process since the caucus date isn't one you even know until the fall.
Okay, so those are the three different both legislative, well, there is for the presidential primary, but I wanted to also show you the changes that another initiative would have on our state primary. So this is obviously not a presidential primary, but hey, since we're talking about primaries, I'll throw out number 98, which is also a ballot initiative, which could potentially be on the ballot for this fall. And this is a combined ballot for the state primary election. The party ID element of this is that there's no limitation on switching parties prior to the primary. So before there was that 29-day limit, there is no limit on switching parties. So you could be a Democrat and the day of the election go, hey, well, wait a minute, I want to be a Republican, so I want to vote their ballot. And then on the ballot, it's got a number of the elements that we just talked about. Affiliated voters vote for the party ballot. The unaffiliated declare a party at the VSP or they receive their mail ballot. ballots clearly distinguish again. Voters can only vote for candidates in one party. Ballots with votes across two parties are void. 75% of the Central Committee can cancel, and minor parties can close. You'll note that there is no section here for funding, and that is because this initiative has no provision for funding. So the pittance that you get in 140 would be replaced by the zero that you got for 98. And then all the other elements are sort of not related because it's not a presidential primary. So those are the three more relevant presidential primary and primary related initiatives and legislation for this year. Martha, and we should start circulating the mic. I think that you have the mic, Representative Pabon. Pass along.
I just wanted to ask a point of clarification. So 98 just affects the state primary. So it would already, we already have a funding mechanism for the state primary.
Zero.
Okay. Exactly. Right. So it doesn't change the status quo on the funding.
It does increase the cost.
Of course it does.
Because they're now creating a super ballot and
a third more ballots are being sent out.
More ballots, but they're also creating something that has never been there before and something they have to figure out on a myriad of voting systems, how to make it so it invalidates it if, as the studies have shown, many people vote in both the Republican and the Democrat, how we fix, how they read that.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to raise, because I think that the only other state that is a mail ballot state that has a combined ballot is the state of Washington. And I have seen that ballot, and I think it would be helpful to have that ballot for this group to look at. What distinguishes Colorado from Washington is a very important point, and that's that Colorado is evenly divided between Democrats, Republicans, and unaffiliateds. Washington is not. And if you ask clerks, and I'd be really interested in Pam and Matt chiming in, and Deb, that I understand from the data from Washington that the amount of spoilage, meaning the amount of ballots that are tossed because people don't follow the directions and they cross vote, is about in the 10 to 12% range. And what I know from Colorado elections is that we have many, 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 many races that are decided in that range because of the makeup of our electorate. And so why I am so adamantly opposed to this measure, and I think this is something this group should maybe talk about, is what we're going to do about this measure and where people are on this measure, is that I think, you know, it's probably going to be great for me because there are going to be lots of election contests, because if I represent candidates who have, you're going to see ballots on the floor that are going to swing that election that aren't counted, and then you're going to have a big fight about what that voter intended and arguments about, well, we can just count that race, Your Honor. We don't have to worry about those other races, but I've got enough votes in that race to swing it. And I think it's a huge issue for us, and it's very unlike what Washington has, because they are not a closely divided electorate. So that was one point I wanted to raise. And then I just lost my train of thought. So maybe I'll leave it at that, and I'll come back if we want to talk about that for a minute.
So, this group, depending on what you wanted to do, has some, I think, some flexibility. If this group wanted to say, we think there are significant problems with this, and here's what those problems are, I think that's within the realm of what this group can do, or to highlight certain issues. And so I think that's up
very much to you in terms of what you first, what you believe about this particular issue and or both of these issues, and what we should tell the people. Because when folks, and most of you are probably aware of this, and please excuse me if I'm telling you things you don't know, when you craft an initiative, there is no requirement you talk to the people who actually would administer the process afterwards. And we have seen issues come with people who had the best intentions in crafting things that when you get to the actual application, they don't work terribly well, or they have significant problems. And this is one of those where people ought to at least be made aware of the issues, and then they can make their judgment as to whether they support it or not.
This is Martha again. I remembered my lost train of thought. The other issue I just wanted to point out for folks here who may not have looked at this is that in our current process, when there is a, in some cases, in certain defects, there is a way for a voter to cure a ballot that may not be able to be counted yet. For example, a signature doesn't match, or they were ID deficient and they forgot to include their ID with their ballot. This, there is no such opportunity. So we will have on the magnitude of 10 to 12% spoilage if the data holds. And there will be no way for those voters to cure their ballots, because the defects won't be discovered until the envelope is separated from the ballot. And at that time, the ballot is anonymous and there's no way to contact the voter. So I think that's another really important point for the voters to know, that there will be a lot of spoilage and there will be no cure.
So Matt's got a comment.
One month.
So the question, yeah, the question was when would this be submitted to our office? It's due on August 8th. In fact, we had a press release this morning that Lynn sent out, which kind of outlines the timing. But they can submit earlier. And in fact, we've asked initiative signature gatherers to please go ahead and submit early if you've got it. Because as you'll hear in the next couple of issues, we have other significant timing and resource issues that will strike later on in our cycle here. Matt.
Just to provide a little more context to Martha's comments, the association is very concerned because, as she said, in Washington, their residual vote rate, their error rate, is in the 10 to 12% range. Ours here in Colorado traditionally has been a little under 2%. And as ballot design has improved here tremendously over the last few years, that number has gone down even further. So we see this as a real serious issue with this proposal.
Other comments? Yes, down this way. You guys didn't know that you were doing daisy chain here in the middle, huh?
Everybody gets an arm workout. Yeah. This is Steve House. My question goes to a discussion that Martha and I have had in the past and with some of the legislators. Is it actually allowable for the state to tell me when I can hold my caucus? Because one of the great concerns about this is the viability of caucus. And if you'd set in this statute that I have the option of the Saturday after, or I can obviously do it the 1st of March, I believe we're going to contest that. I'm going to let you know. I think we should be able to do our caucus whenever we want. We're a private membership organization. We're going to do it on the day and time, maybe over a 10-day period, that makes the most sense for the party. And I don't know whether that would invalidate this, but I think we need to look at the possibility that we should not have to adhere to some arbitrary caucus date set by either this ballot initiative or the legislature, period.
I don't know that I have seen a legal contest over the states dictating a number of things in statute. And I think there may indeed be a First Amendment or other challenge that could be brought. I can't say it would succeed. But from everything from dictating who's on your central committee to what the processes are, and I will leave that to the... You know how to serve us when you're ready to file your lawsuit, as I look at the two parties. We will not duck service. We will accept service.
Elena.
Uh, This is Elena, and we supported the legislation, and we haven't taken a position yet on the ballot measures, although we do share the concerns that I think have been raised by a lot of the folks around the table. I do think it would be useful, and I know that the idea is to set up working groups, and maybe the working group reports back, or maybe it's something for the full group, but I would be interested to delve into these issues a little bit more, particularly around ballot design and spoilage, because I think, you know, 10 to 12% is probably an optimistic spoiler rate for us, and I think that's huge. And then I'm also concerned, and we haven't delved into this as much, about what this means in terms of audit, because I think there are some significant issues as well, just in terms of the integrity of the election, the way that 98 and 140 would set up a process, just what does that look like from an administrative perspective for post-election processes as well? And, you know, to be clear, as I said, you know, Common Cause, we support a presidential primary. We think there's a way to do it that's effective and that there's a way to give unaffiliated voters a role that's accessible and convenient. I think we have one under the current system, and I think we could have one under the legislation that was proposed. But I do think, assuming this were to pass, there are some serious concerns in terms of the integrity of the election process that it would be worth, as a full group, us all talking about and thinking through what would that look like.
Other comments or questions at this time? I've got a couple of more slides here. I'm not sure what you can see from this one, but do your best, squint if necessary. And it is in your packet. This shows the presidential selection process in each state. The problem with this table, though, is that it doesn't distinguish between caucuses and primaries. It just sort of says if they have open, what kind of open, if they have closed, what kind of closed. If you look up caucus and primary, it breaks pretty much 50-50. There are about the same number of caucus states as there are primary states. But this gives you an idea of kind of where we fall in the spectrum of closed versus open. We are defined here as one of the very few states that make our selection process open to unaffiliated voters in a narrow way. It looks like, from my reading of this, that there are either open processes, which include everybody in the various forms that we've discussed, and then there are ones that are closed, and we are in that small group of states that have carved out this exception for unaffiliated, and that's the second page. It kind of breaks, you know, there's no obvious trend. Because there's no obvious trend, and there's every state, even these states that have closed and open, have their own variations on closed and open. There's really no kind of right or wrong. There's no, you know, progressive or progress in a particular area or direction, which doesn't really give us a lot of insight into where we should go, other than maybe we universally find reasons to oppose what's been potentially will maybe be on the ballot. So, yes.
Going back to the spoilage concerns in Washington, and now looking at this chart of all the different states, is it possible for us to also look at, there's reference to at least one state that does the top two. We honor plurality. And I've talked with family members around the state. I had a three-way primary in 10, and they're like, well, you had a runoff, the top, no. So with that level of spoilage from Washington applied to a state where we do honor plurality, how do these other states do that? Do you have to have a majority? Does a candidate need to achieve 50% plus one or somewhere in there in a primary? And is it possible to get an idea of how states view plurality?
Sure. But, yeah, and I'll talk generally, and Jed may add to this while I vamp here, but there are two states. Louisiana has long had a process where in November they vote. If someone gets 51 or 50% plus one, they are the senator. But if there's a minor party candidate, if there are multiple Republicans or multiple Democrats, they then go to a runoff in the December time frame when that vote takes place. California switched to something similar to that, but they have their primary at the traditional time and the runoff in November. So it's everyone running together. In terms of a pure partisan primary where the Republicans have their race and the Democrats have their race, I am not aware of states that have the runoff for that. There are some challenges in that process because that means there's two ways to address it. One is you have a separate election for that runoff, like Denver, Colorado Springs do in their mayoral elections. The challenge in that is, so we're talking, okay, so you got to finish the one election, got to have the canvas of it, then you got to prepare the ballots, mail them out 45 days ahead of time to the military. And so you were talking about adding, and particularly if there's a contest or a recount, you're talking about adding perhaps as much as 3 months to the process. That is challenging. And so I'm not aware of many states or any states, Judge, because Judd, by the way, is the head of the National Association of State Elections Directors, or will be.
The incoming president.
Incoming president. So he's got frequent communication with his colleagues. But doing that runoff would add, or, and the other way you could do it, and there's some proposals to do it now, where you have things like ranked choice voting, where you say, my first choice is, I'll use the Senate race since we just had one. My first choice is Daryl Glenn, my second is Jack Graham, my third is, and then you start eliminating, so you take all of Kaiser's and all of Frazier's votes and you allocate them to see who they voted for as their second or third choice, and then you eliminate another candidate and you go to that. Many of the existing machines in Colorado do not have any possibility of calculating those, so you would be doing it by hand, or some of the newer systems may allow that, but that would be a significant change and would result in some very different campaigning if you did that way. So those are the two ways. You either vote all at the same time and you vote for your second or third choice, which also is going to confuse some voters, because I have a hard time sometimes figuring out who my first choice is, so I'm not sure if I wanted to get my second, my third, and my fourth all in order, whether I do very well at it. But those are the two ways of doing it. So you either add a lot of time to the process, or you do something at the same time you vote the normal way if you wanted to add the runoff.
So this is Elena again. Just to kind of follow up on Senator Holbert's point, I think the chart we have is for non-presidential primaries, and it might be useful, and I don't know if that was what was on the screen or if it was the presidential, to distinguish, because even states that have top two or some of these more creative ways of doing preference, it's different for presidential. So we may decide to tackle both topics, and I'd be interested in that, but we may also want to focus on presidential since that's what's being proposed, at least, you know, the bulk of our conversation. And I don't know if we could get that from NCSL, what that looks like, because I think some of the other states, it would be useful to see how they do it.
Well, and actually, I mean, one question that I have, and maybe this is for the legislators or other people that had a role in the legislation this last year, is I do understand that there are calendar limitations and there are sort of decisions about what can happen during a legislative session. So like what campaigning can happen during a legislative session and whether you want to do that. But just thinking of it from a administration perspective, both us, but we're not nearly as affected as a county would be, combining presidential and state primaries seems pretty attractive to me, because it would reduce the number of elections we're talking about, reduce the expense associated with those. And yes, there are some downstream consequences, but those downstream consequences, you know, are more logistical than they are preventative, which I know from a county perspective, the idea of doing two separate elections and potentially a runoff is a little scary.
Let me ask, because there are a couple other topics we do want to cover today. Probably the next meeting, this ought to be at that point we'll know whether the initiative has been turned in. And so let's kind of look at having a more in-depth discussion of this issue then, if that's agreeable to folks. And at that point, deciding, do we want to do a formal statement from this group that these are the concerns we have, or these are the issues, and maybe that's the way to go. But I'm throwing this out as an idea because this is just my thought.
Or that we love it.
Or that we love it and go for it. But I haven't heard a whole lot of comments on that side. Does that sound agreeable to folks? Okay. I'm not seeing any objection to it, and I'm seeing some heads go up and down. So let's then, if there's no other topics on this subject, and I don't know if anyone signed up for this specific subject back there.
Oh, yes. I don't. Do Jennifer, do you? Is there the sign-up sheet close to you? Has anybody signed up to speak on presidential primary? Harvey, would you like to take the mic and comment?
Thank you very much. Harvey Branscom from Eagle County. I haven't heard my perspective voiced here, so I hope this is going to be fresh. I actually delivered a brief talk to the Republican senators who organized a listening session down at the Capitol a few weeks ago. It's pretty clear that several different pressures are coming in here. One is a concern about whether the caucus, there seems to be widespread concern whether the caucus is actually providing a positive function. And I want to just make it very clear that what I heard at that listening session and what I hear all the time, what I read on the net is, and what I understand myself, is that it's very important that the fact of the local caucus and the transition from there to a county convention and then a state convention and then finally a national convention before we actually have a presidential election is a really important thing. It actually provides localism, it provides definition to the parties, and that's why the timing is so critical about introducing a presidential primary vis-a-vis the caucus. We do not want to have the presidential primary interfere with the fact of the caucus. And I believe we'd like to have the caucus actually be presidentially aware. And that's one of the reasons why the caucus actually draws in a lot of new party members, and that's a good thing for the parties. And the parties have to actually administer the caucuses well enough so that they can handle the load, and they need to be able to allow their attendees to actually speak or actually vote at a preference poll. So I'm really strongly thinking that it's an unwise idea to have a presidential primary that's added in as a new election that flops down on top of the caucus, somewhere near the caucus. And that's the extent to which I really disagree with the proposed ballot initiatives. The other pressure that's coming in is from unaffiliated voters who feel they're left out. Okay, and that's a very big selling point for these two ballot initiatives, at least for both of them. And I believe there's a solution to that. And I believe the solution to that that's actually satisfactory to the parties, maybe even beneficial to the parties. And it hasn't really been mentioned here, but it's a modification of the form of the ballot that you provide to the unaffiliated voters. If that ballot was a combined ballot that had all the candidates on it, and it was separately tabulated, obviously it has to be separately tabulated because it's a different form of ballot, but it would be tabulated under the rules of approval voting. It's not necessary to go to instant runoff voting, which is a very complex, difficult to audit, not compatible voting mechanism. But approval voting, and I have a few cards here that actually explain it for those who don't know what it is. Approval voting is just removing the rule that you can only vote for one. And in fact, in this case, it would remove the rule that you can only vote for one party. So in that sense, I would ask the legislator to change what the ballot initiative, either one of those might produce. which is that strange, both of them, you have to choose the party. If you make a mistake of voting in both parties, then you lose your vote. That is a ridiculous and unacceptable arrangement. And it's been well covered here. But there is a solution to that, which is to actually open that so that you are allowed to vote for any of the candidates on that ballot. And the result of that election would be provided to the parties, and they could actually select out of there, if they wanted to have the open primary solution, they can take the results of their closed primary, effectively, or the primary that we run today, and add to it the unaffiliated votes that were for the candidates from their party, and then they would have the result of an open primary. They just have to add the two together. But it's at their discretion. So that lets the parties decide how they want to handle that, gives a voice to the unaffiliated who are not able to vote in the primary because they chose not to actually affiliate. And that actually seems to solve the problem for all the parties in question to me. So I'll be interested in hearing from you privately, perhaps, about what problems there might be with that solution. But I think that's the direction that we ought to head were one of these ballot initiatives to actually come into place. And even I would recommend moving that direction, even if the ballot initiatives don't. So that's my public comment on the topic.
Great. Thank you. Were there other public members of the public that wanted to speak on this issue? Not seeing anyone, but maybe I'll look behind me. No? Everybody shrugs.
Well, the other two people who signed the list didn't sign an agenda topic.
There you go. So I guess they didn't. Great. So we will, for a moment, step away from presidential primary. We'll, at the end of the meeting, we're going to talk about committee assignments and so forth. It may be that this one might be a better committee assignment at a later date, although you will have some ideas on that.
Yeah, I think in terms of the working group concept where you're trying to come up with a proposal, that's more if the initiatives don't pass. I think probably the whole body next meeting will discuss what we want to tell people, what information we want to provide to people out of this body to say, hey, we're the Bipartisan Election Advisory Commission. Here are the things you ought to be aware of, or here are the concerns we have with this particular proposal. And we'll plan on that for the next meeting. But let's move on to our next topic.
Next topic. So our next topic is recall. And the oddities that exist between the constitutional provisions on recall and the statutory provisions on recall. And I've asked Melissa Polk, she the one sitting here at the front, to come and give us sort of the broad overview of that. And then I know the secretary has many thoughts on recall and many experiences that he can relate for us. So, Melissa.
Great. Thanks, Judd. As I look around at the commission members, I understand that many of you will already understand a lot of these issues, so I'll keep my comments on it brief. Our office and the clerks continue to struggle with several of the conflicts between Article 21 of the Colorado Constitution and state and federal laws. The constitutional framework for recall elections became effective in 1913. Obviously, a lot has changed in elections since then. Post House Bill 1303, we now are a mail ballot election state. We no longer rely on the traditional definition of election day. We mail ballots several weeks in advance. We have VSPCs, voter service and polling centers, open for several days beforehand. And of course, we have to mail ballots to or deliver ballots to our military and overseas voters 45 days prior to election day. So some of the problems have been fixed. Some of the problems with Article 21 have been fixed with amendments to Title I. However, there's still no way for a county clerk or for the secretary's office to comply with all of the federal and state requirements and also comply with those constitutional provisions. So as you know, our second topic today is recall constitutional changes. Our one specific example of the timeline conflicts between the Constitution and statutes is that under the constitutional framework, successor candidates for a recall election don't have to file their petitions until 15 days before the recall election, so before recall election day. Under our modern mail ballot system, we require certification of the ballot 60 days before election day. So that's a vast difference between when we have to have ballot content certified and available to clerks so they can print and get those ballots out to our UOCAVA voters. And, you know, that 15-day deadline. And at that point, you know, we're already at the mailing out ballot stage. And so, you know, I think what we're looking for is not obviously to limit the right to recall election, but to bring some of those timelines up to speed with current state and federal law. And I know the secretary has obviously, as he said, run a significant number of recall elections and has some examples of the timeline conflicts between those two.
So let me talk to you about a recall that took place and a recall that almost or tried to take place. So first I'll go back to the recall election of Senator Morse. At that point, the Secretary of State had issued a rule to try to get around this 15-day limit because the Constitution says successor candidates shall be, I think the wording is not later than 15 days beforehand. And so Scott issued a rule that said, well, 60 days beforehand, or I forget the exact number, is also not later than, so that's the rule, and the court struck it down. We had a candidate who turned in successor petitions 15 days before the election, just like it says. Now, lest you think that triggers everything being done, we then have to review the petitions to figure out whether she turned in sufficient signatures. The conclusion was that she did not. That was actually reviewed by the Secretary of State's office. She then has an appeal period set under the statute. And so we found out at 12:01 a.m. on Wednesday before a Tuesday election that we could proceed. That's because she didn't file an appeal. If she had filed an appeal of the non-qualification, it would have been a couple days later. So we knew basically 5 days before the election who was going to be on the ballot. Now, there is no way to effectively prepare and mail ballots and hope they get there. The Postal Service standard is 5 to 7 business days in any remote fashion of occurring. That was that law. Now, the legislature then passed a bill following this to try to address it and said, well, the Constitution, just like Secretary Gessler tried to issue a rule, they passed a bill that says, well, the Constitution means the day of the election is the first day ballots go out. So 22 days before the election, so we add 15 to that, so it's 37 days before the election. So let's go ahead then to the 2014 election when we have a sheriff in El Paso County whose recall is sought. If they had sufficient signatures, and they did not, successor candidates would have been due 37 days before the election. By the Constitution, that had to be part of the general election, because the Constitution says if it's so many days before the general election, it goes on the general election ballot. Under federal law, every military member, every overseas voter must be sent a ballot 45 days ahead of the election. So even if you presume the constitutionality and acceptability of redefining election day, so the deadline is 37 days before the election, there is no way to get the petition in and mail out 45 days ahead of time. And so we talked with the Secretary of State, and we were coming up with, well, we could put the question of the recall and then put the successor as a second ballot, except the Constitution says they're supposed to be part of the same ballot question. And so there is no way to reconcile a Colorado constitutional provision with the requirements of federal law, let alone however Colorado does things, which, and so ultimately, the only way to fix this is to go to the people and say, we need to change the constitutional provisions of Colorado so they match federal law, so they match the way we do things. And that requires a constitutional amendment. this, which, by the way, can't, no way to get it on this year's ballot, and it can't go on 2017 because it's not a Tabor. So this is a 2018 issue. So this is not a pressing issue in the sense of I'm not asking for action today, but this is one of the subjects this I want this body to talk about. How do we come up with, and we've seen recalls used both by the left and by the right. The idea is not to take away the people's right to recall. When there was a proposal, and that, by the way, is why he wasn't able to be here today, but why Victor Head is listed as, so I had one appointment from the voting rights groups and one from the voting integrity groups, and that was kind of the slot he filled. We need to have, because a prior recall ballot proposal got shot down by Coloradans because they felt like they were trying to take away their right to recall. And so we've got to come up with a way that provides that right in a reasonable fashion and also has a reasonably speedy way, because if you've got someone who is corrupt, who is abusing their office, who is doing things they're not supposed to, the whole idea is there's supposed to be a process for removing them that's reasonably speedy. And so how do we reconcile that? And that's a big question, because you're looking at the interplays of the federal law, state law, how we run elections in Colorado, and then how do we change that? So that's a large topic, and we don't need a lot of discussion on it now, but I wanted to just say this is one of the things I want this group to tackle, because I think we have to do something, because otherwise you're going to have clerks ultimately getting sued. And we were advising the Jefferson County clerk with respect to what happens if successor candidates show up a certain number of dates. And that's a state election which didn't have to be compliant with the federal UACAVA rules. The Makita situation, the El Paso County Sheriff situation, is one that would have had to be part of federal UACAVA rules. And so there was literally no way I could have complied with all of those requirements. So that's a topic.
I've been part of some of those fights, so I know how tricky that is. It seems to me, though, that while I think it's really an important fix, it's not a very hard fix. I mean, it seems to me that we put the right of recall, we keep the right of recall in the Constitution, but all the dates go in the statute, because you can't end up with this kind, I mean, elections evolve in terms of technology and efficiency and how we do them, and I think putting those kinds of dates in the Constitution is folly at this point. We make sure we preserve that right. We can have language about how it has to be carried out expeditiously or something like that, but not the 15 days, 27 days, even 45 days. I mean, that will become obsolete. So I think it's not a good idea to continue to now put what current law is in the Constitution.
And I think that's a good point. The challenge is some people are suspicious of government. I know this shocks folks in the room to hear. If you say, well, we trust the legislature to set these dates, there is, if you look at the sentiment in the 1913 constitutional amendment, is we don't trust the legislature to do anything. We, the people, retain the sole power. No judge can tell us what to do. No, I mean, it's very suspicious of government. And that's what the progressive movement was that instituted this in that time frame. And so if we do that, we've got to have some language that people feel protects them from a legislator saying, well, expeditiously means within the same presidential term. Government expeditious. But I think that is a way we have to look at it. But we're going to have to make sure that people feel like their right is protected under it.
The secretary mentioned there was a 2006 attempt to adjust the recall timelines and a constitutional referendum, and it died 60-40. So it lost by a lot. It wasn't a close election. Obviously, we would probably want to craft it in such a way that was less likely to draw the slings and arrows of those who opposed that one. So, okay, so that was a quick little issue. And then thank you, Melissa. And then we're going to jump into, for my money, the most exciting one of the three. Let's see. You're with me? Oh, yeah, that's good. All right, so do you want to do... I've got it open on my computer. Okay, so this is... Oops, I didn't mean to do that. Cancel. There we go. This is about signature verifications for petitions. So this is probably the one that we will want to form a working group today on. And so kind of be thinking about that as you're looking at it. Is this one that you want to spend some extra time on? It has a whole bunch of sort of longstanding ramifications and will be a kind of a difficult needle to thread. So the broader picture of this is that we have three ways in which we do petitions in the state of Colorado. We do them for initiatives, we do them for candidates, we do them for recall. I'll go through each one here in a minute. Currently, the way we have requirements for each one of those petitions, you have to have so many signatures, they have to be in by certain dates, those kinds of things. And then there's a whole bunch of the law which limits us in how we review those, what our parameters for review are, what our timeline is, that kind of stuff. All of them are different in their way. The quest right now, none of those are done by signature verification, at least not at the state level. Some counties, one that I know of in particular who's represented here today, does do signature verification. That's Denver. And I'm not sure that others do. Does Arapahoe or Logan do signature verification?
Denver has no rule authority.
So you guys are, but you guys do not do signature verification on your reviews, right? So that means that we've got this kind of odd system where things are being done differently at different in different areas of the government, and they're being done differently across different kinds of petitions. And if we were going to try to install some sort of signature verification process, it would need to affect a whole bunch of other areas of state petition law. Did I give a broad enough overview of that? Any questions along those lines before we jump in? Okay. So,
yes. I'd just say the topic is broader than just signature verification. It's the whole process
for petitions,
petitioning for ballot access in this area.
Okay, so first I jump into initiatives. So I'm going to talk about initiatives first, then candidates, then recall. So this is the constitutional basis for initiative petition review. The constitutional provisions were in the original constitutional language. In Article 5, Section 1, it provides that citizens can do a citizen initiative process. And then sub 6 of Section 1 says, the affidavit for the circulator is evidence that signatures are genuine. So the Constitution says basically you don't have to review the signatures. In fact, you don't even have to review the information that's in the jurat, you know, the boxes that people fill in. That's what the Constitution says about initiatives. There's also a statutory basis for initiative petition review. This is sort of the modern era of petition review. I will note that a whole bunch of this is kind of cobbled together from a 1980 law, the 1992 revision of Title I, And then some other chunks that are always sort of in constant review. Legislators are often updating some elements of these every, you know, two or three cycles. In 141.16, the secretary must review each voter entry to determine if the person is a registered voter or registered to vote. And then I'm quoting from the statute for these next two. In sub 2 of that section, the secretary shall examine each name and signature on the petition and assure that the information was written by the person making the signature. So this is interesting. Does this mean that we already should be doing an analysis of the signature? That's certainly one way that you could read that. That's not the way that this office has interpreted that for the last, forever. But we could interpret it to already say that, which would necessitate a whole bunch of changes in process.
And let me throw out, for the process, and some of you who've been at an election day or have run the elections know that when you mail a ballot out to a voter, that ballot has a barcode. And when that, assuming they return the ballot in the envelope they were sent, which most of them do, you're able to scan that barcode in and it pulls up the signature so the clerk's judges can compare that signature to see if it matches. Great. And Colorado clerks in the last presidential election reviewed 2.6, well, not quite 2.6 million because we weren't quite mail ballot then, but go back to the last general, it was 2 million.
Yeah, right.
Approximately 2 million signatures clerks were able to review this way and get it done within a reasonably quick fashion. When you look at petitions for to put an issue on the ballot that need 98,000, so they're turning in 150 to potentially 200,000, we could have, 8, 10. We might be reviewing a couple million signatures, but there's no barcode. Someone has printed their name and an address, which means we type that name in. We hope it shows up. And then we compare it to what's there, but it's a much longer process than the scan that pulls up an automatic file. And so you were talking a very lengthy process and time-consuming process if this is what we do, which is why it hasn't been done historically. And remember, when the Constitution's passed, there's no statewide voter database. There isn't one in the 1876 provisions. Mm-hmm. And so this is a different process now with the statute.
And then the last provision on this page is that the Secretary of State's office does a 5% review of initiatives that are submitted. So that means we count up the lines, we figure out how many you've got, we do a 5% review, which we randomly select from all of those petition pages, figure out the percentage of acceptable signatures of that 5%, and then extrapolate that percentage to the additional 95%, and figure out if we believe that there will be more than 110% signatures submitted so that we can accept it on a 5% review. So what that means practically is that instead of getting 98,492, they would get 98,492 10% more. So basically another 10,000. And we estimate based on our review whether or not they would achieve that. That also translates to below. If they are within 10% above or within 10% below, we cannot accept our determination based on a 5% review. And then we have to do a line by line review. So that means we have to review each one of the signatures submitted. We call signatures, by the way, what we're talking about is the jurat, is the series of boxes that they have to fill in. If you get more than 110% or fewer than 90%, then you, we don't accept it. We either say you're done, fewer than 90%, we cannot accept it, we won't continue to review, or more than 110, we accept it outright. We don't review the additional 95%.
I would note, you saw some press coverage attacking us for caring about the circulator. The reason you care about the circulator in the current system is that's your only assurance the person actually was who they claimed to be. And that's why this office and our rules of the statute place an emphasis on the circulator being legit and accurate, because that's who we're trusting. Because the idea here is we kind of delegate that to the circulator and trust them to be the agent of the government in collecting these signatures. And if you can't trust the circulator, then there's a problem.
Have any states moved to any sort of automated petition system? I didn't see it with my own eyes, but I've heard Victor had and Pueblo had participated in something that would, if they approached a voter on the Pueblo recall effort, they actually looked up that voter's registration to verify that Fred McGillicuddy is in fact a eligible petition signer. And I just wonder if there's any way that through iPad, cell phone, whatever, not to maybe get to the point to have the elector sign that, though that's a possibility, but to build an electronic list of, okay, I'm asking Mr. McGillicuddy to sign this petition. I've looked him up. He is eligible. And then it puts it in some sort of a spreadsheet database at your office or the county clerk to say, okay, these people are signing the petition, and be able to run both against each other. Is anyone doing that?
That's a crazy idea, but it might actually work. In fact, Denver does that right now. So one of you've skipped ahead about 9 pages in my PowerPoint, and but it's certainly one that I think is worth looking at, which we're I think is part of the solutions that we suggest later on. So very good idea. So that's the constitutional and statutory basis for the initiative petition review. Let's jump to candidate petitions. So candidate petitions have no constitutional language. So there's nothing in the Constitution that speaks to candidate petitions. But they do have a statutory provision, and basically the most important element of it is that secretary must review all candidate petitions and compare each entry to the voter's file. That's all it says. It doesn't talk about signatures. It doesn't have any of the other language that we talked about with regard to initiatives. So nothing like that. And then there's recalls. Recall is covered under one constitutional provision, which is Article 21, Section 2. And this says, all petitions shall be deemed and held to be sufficient if they appear to be signed by the requisite number of signers, and such signers shall be deemed and held to be registered electors unless a protest is filed. So that creates an entirely different standard, which the statute ignores in 112.108.8a, and where it says the secretary must review all petition information and verify the information. So even though it sets up this protest idea, the statute then sort of circumvents that and puts it back in our office to do a review. So each one, you can see each one is done differently. Each one has different parameters and requirements, and they all kind of need to be fixed. They all have problems that probably need to be clarified. This is our review process. Secretary already alluded to this in some respects. So the Secretary of State's review process is that we check first, the first thing out of the gate, beyond numbering them and making sure we have all the sections right and ripping them all apart so that they can be reviewed. But as a practical process, we check the circulator affidavits for completeness and accuracy. So this is the part about the circulator that the Secretary was just mentioning. We check to make sure in a candidate petition, that the person is registered to vote, that they're affiliated, and that they live within the district, because all of those things are important elements in a candidate petition. That's why candidate petitions take longer to do than any other kind of petition review. In an initiative petition, we don't have to do those things. All we have to do is make sure that they're registered, that's the one thing, and then that they've signed on the same day as the notary. That's important in that we have to figure out who they are, right? Can they be registered, or are they registered? Can they have signed this petition? And then, hey, did you sign it on the same day as the, did the circulator sign it on the same day as the notary? Well, because that indicates to us that the notary and the circulator were in the same room when the circulator signed that document. We find the signer in SCORE. We compare the signer's name and address to SCORE to determine whether or not the signer is eligible to sign the petition. By the way, for those of you that maybe don't know, you all know, but SCORE is our statewide voter registration database. And then we calculate whether the petition contains enough qualified signatures for the ballot. Again, there's all these different parameters. You need so many signatures for a given race or so many signatures for a given district. And we have to just figure out if there's enough on that. And ironically, that actually turns out to be a pretty difficult question, as we saw in the Republican U.S. Senate race this last year. And but let's point out some recent developments in petition gathering, signature gathering, that might be of interest to you. In 2013, a petition circulator in a petition to recall John Morris was found guilty of forging petition signatures in El Paso County by the El Paso DA. In 2015, candidate Corey Houck was found guilty for forging petition signatures in city and county of Denver. She actually was charged in, actually, it was in the 2015 election. She was actually charged just barely into 16 and was recently pled guilty. Is that right? Pled guilty to forging petition signatures. In 2016, petition circulator for U.S. Senate candidate John Kaiser was charged with forging petition signatures. That just happened, and that is still in the legal process. And then also a more obscure one that you may not know about, in a recall petition circulator in Castle Rock, was investigated for forging signatures but was ultimately exonerated. This was an example of somebody looked at the petition, was concerned that there was reason to believe that potentially this was fraudulent. It was turned over to the DA. The DA did an exhaustive investigation and contacted all of the people that were on those petition sections, and turns out they all did sign it. And so the allegation was false. But it's kind of the counterexample to the other recent developments. So fraud, or the concern of fraud, has sort of become much more prevalent in our lives. So let's talk about some options. We have a couple of different options that we've got. We could remain with the status quo. The status quo is to not review signatures. The secretary, as a consequence of some of these recent developments we've talked about, has instituted policies to catch consistent fraud. These would likely not catch individualized fraud. So if there was like the occasional fraud on one page and then not for several more pages, and then we may not catch that because they're not consistent. We can't see it. We can't easily register it. But we have instituted policies that we think is going to catch the more consistent stuff. IDS, who is our the part of government that does the actual review for our agency, has a heightened awareness of possible fraud based on the things that have happened in the last couple of years. And the Secretary of State's office is investigating improved training for the review team, for the team that does this work for us. So we're looking into that, and we'll, I'm sure, institute some new policies along those lines. And then eSign, which is what the Senator brought up, which is a very interesting possibility, which would in some way systematize this review process. when you institute other changes. And so the way this potentially could work for us would be we would get better, cleaner data. We would have and the way eSign works, by the way, is that it's basically an electronic version of a petition, section. So instead of standing on 16th Street Mall with a clipboard and a pen, and somebody comes by and they fill in their name and their address and their county and all the information that they're required to do in the jurat, they would have the electronic version, and you would put in enough information for the system to look you up. And it says, yes, you are qualified to sign this petition. And if you, put in the right information, include the information you've already provided, then this very likely will be a signature that can be counted. But this system could also include information. It could go the other way and give us a voter ID. And that voter ID could then be electronically inserted into that entry. And then we could go back and do a much more sort of systematized or electronic signature verification because we've got the voter ID. That's what we need. That's the like essential piece of information to do a systematized signature review.
Just to clarify, Victor Head's process they used in Pueblo was to verify the voter was registered, and if they needed to change their registration, they would do it through our mobile app, govotecolorado.com, and they could change their registration so they met the compliance. So they were doing it independently. Denver's eSign actually is interacting directly with the petition signature, and so it's a different process. Denver can do that because they're home rule. The problem in the statute is it talks about things like staples and connections. It's written very much for a existing paper approach, so it requires some statutory changes to go to that, and then some cost. I think Denver provides it to candidates. You don't provide the iPads or...
They can check it out.
Okay, they can check it out, but they pay. Okay. So we could do that. That then adds to the cost of the petition, particularly if you're talking hundreds of circulators out there with their iPads or Androids or whatever the cost. But it gives you a much cleaner and more secure process.
The other great thing about eSign, and I have many reasons to really like eSign. Another great thing about eSign is that it in a pretty discreet way, identifies the time and location where signatures have been gathered. So you can you could figure out that a person was filling in these signatures at 1 o'clock in the morning in their basement based on the information provided by eSign. And if you wanted to do an investigation, if you had some concerns, you could go back and you could figure out that, well, actually, it really does look like this person wasn't walking the neighborhood, knocking on doors, but that they were, doing it at 1 o'clock in the morning. And chances are pretty good that they were just forging them at that point. So that's very interesting. And then on the signature verification front, we could compare the signer's signature with the signature on file. And then the secretary already sort of discussed how that works, but for a mail ballot election, a person gets their ballot, they vote it, they seal up the envelope, and they write their signature on the back, and it's returned. The counties then, in many counties, especially the larger ones, they have kind of an automated process where they can bink in the ballot. The signature then shows up on a computer screen right next to the last signature that was already in the SCORE database. And they can automatically kind of go, yes, yes, yes. Oh, nope, that one's close, And they can go through them pretty quickly based on that. The current process with petitions, we would have the information in the boxes, and we would look up, try to find that voter, find the latest signature and score, look at them one, two, and then make the determination. And instead of it being a 5-second to maybe... 10-second process, it would be a minute plus, maybe 2 or 3 minute process for each signature, and that is kind of a deal killer if you wanted to try to do signature verification.
The other part of that, as the clerks and some of you know, when the signature doesn't match, we mail the voter a letter and says, hey, your signature didn't match. You have until 8 days after the election to correct this. Would you do this with petitions? And if so, are we notifying the campaign? Or are we notifying the individual voter? It adds time to the process. And as some of you are aware, the clerks printed ballots in this last election without knowing who was actually going to be the final candidates that were on the Senate race because we had no choice. It exacerbates if we do this unless we change some timeframes.
And that brings us to implementation consideration. So let's say, yes, Representative Pavone. Yeah, is there a mic? Can you pass it along, please? Thank you.
I have no idea what the constitutional implications of something like this might be. So if it's unconstitutional, I apologize. But has there been any discussion about a registration, licensure, or requirement for commercial circulators or companies that exist to sort of hold them in some ways accountable for their employees? You have the separate criminal charge if the employees engage in forgery, mm-hmm. but how about the companies themselves? Because that's what, I mean, to me, that's what we're really talking about, the sophistication of these signatures. This is commercial, mm-hmm. a commercial operation. And I assume, Deb, that there's commercial operators that are checking out some of these iPads as well to use them, or they will be, or they'll be creating their own system. So I wonder if that's been a discussion at all.
I think that's open to discussion as we go forward. There have been various provisions trying to make the process better that have been struck down by the courts. For example, there was a limitation in Colorado law that says you can't pay by the signature, which is the big, I think, culprit in some sense, because that's what incentivizes a circulator to throw in some extras. I need some extra money. If I put some more names here, I get more money. Some people would resist that temptation. Most do. But obviously, from the evidence, there's some who did not. So I don't know if we've looked at that, but I think it's something that this group could look at. And then you deal with what's the mens rea, or what's the intent by the circulating firm. Is it strict liability? Is it because you could then incentivize that firm that, you know, they have to pay a fine, but then what if it's just a fly-by-night corporation set up for that? So, but I think that's a fair way of looking at it, to say, let's look at some teeth there potentially.
And we haven't been all that successful in litigation on the various initiative restrictions. We've won some, we've lost some, so it's kind of hit or miss. It seems like courts, especially the federal courts where we've ended up mostly on these, are pretty reluctant to create more barriers on the circulating organizations.
Well, and I guess it would be more... probably more of a registration piece, and it would just be a deterrent piece that essentially, if there's violations found within your operation, those will be public violations or whatever they may be, something to just simply not necessarily punish in the general sense, but just to provide some transparency. And usually the problem can take care of itself, because these circulators are pretty competitive these days, and there's a lot more of them, and there's a lot more coming online. I mean, it's a real business, and sometimes it's a side business, which maybe that makes sense in some cases, sometimes it doesn't, because it's such an important requirement under the Constitution. So something to consider. This is, of course, coming from the Democrat trying to regulate a commercial enterprise, but aside from that,
remember that. Elena, do you have a... There it is. Now it's on.
Okay. This is Elena. I know that there's a requirement that petition entities register, and that's still good law. Is there any tracking or, to Representative Pabon's point, is there anything that actually follows through if there are complaints or investigations so one could look up a petition entity and see that they've got a history of abuse or anything like that? Because I think that might still be in the realm of something that could be regulated since we have a registration requirement already for commercial petition entities. So it's maybe just a reporting thing.
So we can work backwards. If there's a complaint about somebody, or in the case of some of these other examples, we end up in the legal system, we can piece it back together. But it's not unusual for an initiative, I'm not sure so much about candidates, although maybe, that an initiative will often hire more than one circulator. And so trying to figure out who... or circulating entity. So trying to figure out who worked for who is probably something we could reconstruct. But yeah, those are all that we have, all of that information, whether or not it's actually organized. I don't know. That
right.
It is.
And is there still the requirement to file the report after you've submitted signatures on who you've paid and how much? Because I mean, that gives pretty detailed information and seems like it could easily be adjusted if it's not already included, so you could tie it back to a firm and not just a scene. I mean, I remember it being rather detailed when we had to submit it in the past.
Yeah, my only concern or question about that would be, would an individual circulator potentially work for multiple firms and potentially work for multiple firms doing the same candidate or the same entity? I mean, that could potentially happen. But anyway, yes. So we do have that data. We just have to go back and collect it. So it's not available in the sort of form that you're describing. So implementation considerations for signature verification on petitions. The first and probably the one that we'll all come back to the most is time. For initiatives, we have 30 days to complete that 5% review on a line by line. We have 30 days to do the review. The problem that we experience isn't so much the 30 days, because most of the time we can do a review in 30 days without much trouble. It's that they all sort of line up to do the same 30 days. If they all had their own 30 days, then I think that we could probably pull it off. But the way it is the Constitution says that that an initiative may be submitted 90 days prior to the election. And those 90 days encompass the 30 days that we need to do that review, and all of those initiatives, many of those initiatives will use that same 30 days. So a 5% review, we can do a 5% review in, you know, several days, not really much of a problem. A line by line might take us a couple of weeks or more to do with 150,000 or so. The good example, the last major line by line that we did, the one that stands out in my head, I think we actually did one after this, was the marijuana initiative. They submitted 198,000 signatures, so almost 200,000 signatures, and their overall rate of acceptance with a line by line, so they didn't make it through the 10%, but the overall rate of acceptance with a line by line was just less than 50%. So they actually had less than 50% acceptance rate, but they just barely made it. They made it with like 51% of what they needed. They got like 101,000 signatures. So in that case, we had to do a whole bunch of work because of the additional 50,000 signatures you wouldn't have anticipated. And the rate was lower, and you spend more time on the ones that you're not going to accept. So that created sort of a double whammy for us, and that can happen sometimes. In a candidate situation, the SOS and the counties, because this is also a county issue, has until ballot certification. So and that's a 25-day process from the end of the date in which the candidates can circulate and submit So 25 days. And then there is also a protest window. So as a practical matter, you really only have 20 days because you have that five-day protest. And you can't work the protest up to the date of certification because that will blow up your certification, which is kind of what happened to us this last time.
And this presumes that you don't have then court litigation after the protest. And that's what happened with this last cycle, exacerbated by the fact that three of them turned in, just like in school, on the deadline. If you say this is the deadline, if you go to a motor vehicle office on the last day of the month, everybody will be there. And everyone turned in, with the exception of Mr. Graham, all three Senate candidates turned them in on the last possible date. And so that all of this exacerbates. And then with the Senate race, for those who aren't aware, you can't sign more than one petition. And so we have to do them sequentially. You can't even do them simultaneously because we have to figure out who signed Mr. Graham's petition before we can figure out who signed Mr. Blaha and then who signed Mr. Frazier's. Mm-hmm. And we've got to go. That's the fun.
Yeah, and those in particular, the candidate ones, when you're talking about candidates for the same office from the same party, that really presents a problem for us because we have to do them. All we can do is pre-process. We can't actually begin to process lines until we've completed the last one. And even at the end of completing a line-by-line review, which is all you do for a candidate, you then have to do the post-processing to make sure you did it all right. And then you can start the line-by-line processing of the next candidate. So they really are stacked on top of each other. It's really creates quite a little timing burden. And then recalls, the Constitution says 15 business days. So that you might equate to around 21 days total. Another significant consideration, are you going to have enough qualified people to be able to take on the duties to do a signature verification? The counties collect enough people to do this, so maybe there's a resource or sort of reservoir of people out there that we could tap into, but we would have to train them up. And would we have them be doing a separate part of the process and have IDS do the other part, or would we, ask IDS to hire new people to take on more of a greater role in that process? All of those would have to be figured out along with training. And then, and this taps back into the e-sign idea, is there equipment that we could employ to do signature review? Some counties, even those represented in this room, do some form of automatic signature verification by binking in those ballots. They know who that person is, and they can automatically link to the signature on file and have the system, which is, set up with, identifying 18 points of comparison, and it can very quickly, in a blink of an eye, say yes or no, based on the parameters set by the people who oversee that process. So you could say, I want the best 50%, or I want the best 60%, the ones that are the most indisputable, to automatically go through, and I'll do a hand review on the rest. Or you could say, I want, if they meet 12 points of criteria, then they automatically go through, no matter what that percentage is. So you can set those parameters based on, the abilities of the equipment. If we had eSign, and we were pulling that voter ID in, we could set up a system to be able to do that review. And we would just need to work with a manufacturer to be able to create something that would be able to automatically do that verification. Let me just tell you, for the legislators that are here today, those pieces of equipment are very expensive. And we would probably be asking somebody for some money because that's as Matt and others can point out, cost a chunk of change. We could also, the secretary brought up this morning, hey, the circulators are out there circulating, and they're the ones that care about the initiative. Maybe they should be providing the voter ID number. Maybe they should be looking up all of their voters and providing the voter ID number, and then we'll systematize it on the back end. That's an interesting idea, and it would circulators could charge a lot more money then. So I don't know if that's a great idea or not. maybe it's the circulator employment bill. I don't know.
Well, then we also throw in an initiative that's being circulated out there to say you have to get the signatures from each Senate district, state Senate district, which then adds a significant longer piece to the review as well.
Yeah. Other considerations, the election calendar. So this is again, rubber meets the road kind of stuff. The timing of the petition deadlines and the effect that that would have on the caucus and assembly process if we tried to move them. So let's say right now we've got 25 days to do these, we've got 30 days to do these, and we've got 21 days to do these, right? Well, what if we said, because we're doing signature verification, we need to have expanded time? Well, if we have expanded time, chances are that's going to domino into the caucus and assembly process. And other calendar-related problems.
And to give you a couple of quick examples, the DA in Adams County didn't make the ballot, but he got 10%. And the system in Colorado was set up so you could go out then and get signatures. Fine, he did, and he actually won the primary. But using two other examples, your Arapahoe County Commissioner Rod Bockenfeld had his House District Assembly on the Saturday before petitions were due. He got 29.9%. And he called us up and said, could you approve petitions? And we said, sure, you have until Monday to finish them. He didn't do it. And then we go to your dad, who, you know, didn't get the 30%, and there's no way he could do anything because the state assembly took place after the petition deadline. And so there's no way he could say, well, let me go out then and get signatures. And so already by some changes in Colorado law, this go to the assembly, if you get between 10 and 30, you can petition on, doesn't practically work in most circumstances. And if you add additional time frame to it, it gets even worse.
Yeah, it backs up even more. I mentioned the constitutional conflicts already. We have a 90-day requirement for initiatives before Election Day, so you have to work back from Election Day 90 days. And that sets the parameters for the last 30 days that we have to review. That's when we tend to get all of the initiatives. So if we wanted to expand, right now that's August 8th. So August 8th is the day that we're going to get a whole bunch of initiatives. Hopefully we'll get some earlier than that, but we're probably going to get a whole bunch on the 8th. If we wanted, let's say, if we could just buy 30 more days, right? Well, if we, to buy 30 more days, we've got to do a constitutional amendment because we tried through legislation back in 2010 to, or actually maybe 2008, we tried to expand that to 3 months plus 30 days through legislation, and the court shot that down and said that that was not permitted under Colorado Constitution. So we would have to, I think at this point, it would require a constitutional amendment. Also, we have this interesting recall provision that says that the signatures are deemed valid, which we kind of ignore. I think if anybody ever called us on that, the Constitution's pretty clear, and we would probably have a problem with us trying to incorporate both the statute and the constitutional provisions. Secretary already brought up the opportunity to cure issue. In all the other signature verification ways in which we do signature verification in the election process, we allow for people whose signatures, you know, they change. Somebody broke their arm. Somebody's had a stroke. There's a visible change to their signature. I know one particular person who every 5 to 10 years in his life, he just changes his signature, because he knows it's PII, and after 5 years or so, he wants to change it up because he doesn't want people having that personal piece of information. Well, that means we're probably not going to verify his signature. Should he get a chance, an opportunity to cure that signature? And that's one of those things that's that would further complicate the verification of signatures and the timing, because right now in state statute, for signature verifications on a ballot, we allow 8 days. We don't have 8 days to give in this process, but if we wanted to do something like that, we would have to find 8 days somewhere, or maybe something like 8 days. And then, did you want to comment on that?
I was going to say, we haven't talked about money in this process really as a specific topic, but obviously each of these things have some monetary cost. That can be worked around. The timing is, I think, the bigger concern, because particularly because you're looking at a legislative session. So when do you do candidate petitions? Well, and particularly for those of our representatives and senators who represent the remote areas of Colorado, how do you get back to Durango or Steamboat Springs to run a campaign if we're going to push it back further? I mean, Chris and Patrick, I think, go home every night. It's a little different for them. They can catch an evening event in Castle Rock or Highlands Ranch, but you can't do that if you're Alan Roberts in Durango.
And then the last thing that we put on as a potential consideration for implementation is maybe we can buy ourselves a little bit of review time by trimming the percentage that we need to review to do that first review, the 5% review, or by narrowing the margin that's acceptable. Right now it's 10% above or 10% below, which is constitute 20%. Right now it's between 110 and 90. What if we said, 105 and 95? It has happened once in the history of our office where if we would have said, yes, it made it at 105, it ultimately didn't make it. That happened once where we did a line by line and found that the stuff we reviewed first ultimately, didn't quite make it to the necessary number. But it's only happened once, and we've done, dozens and dozens of reviews in the last, 15, 20 years. So that's another thing to consider. One little complication, I'll just throw out one complication to that. One thing about the 5% review, one of the reasons why the margin is bigger is if you have a person that signed multiple times on the same petition, we're probably not going to catch it in the 5% review. But we will catch it in the line-by-line review. And so we have had an instance in the past where that was the case, where people signed multiple times, and we really only found that out when we were looking at the whole thing. And that's why potentially those margins are bigger. So, and I think that was it.
So, as you can see, there's a lot of complications and a lot of detail, and so this is the one that we wanted to kind of set up a working group to kind of review and say, what does make sense going forward as it impacts legislative issues, as it impacts other things. And so are there people who would be interested in serving on that? Patrick.
Okay, Representative Neville, Elena. Anybody else?
Is there a clerk?
Just two?
Who'd be interested in?
I like it. I'm going to join you on that one. So I'm just going to add myself. Judge. Dead. Okay. Anybody else?
Deb. Okay. That gives us
great.
Okay, that gives us a good working group with some things, and so we'll let you all do that. See, we just did item 8, and now item 9. I think the next meeting will focus on, because obviously this is going to require legislative change and some other things, so this doesn't need to happen as soon, but I think we need to talk about at our next meeting, assuming that it's on the ballot, what we're going to do in terms of primaries and the initiative and what we want to advise people of. So as we look at our next meeting schedule, that's what I think is kind of the next priority. But the other thing I wanted to do is this sentence, but are there specific other topics that you think would be good
that this group should be talking about? Because we just came up with some that I thought, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Hello. There we go. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We have talked about this. There's been different bills introduced to try to dabble around the edges, but every time we go through election cycle in Douglas County, having walked many of those precincts myself, I find voters who say, no, we're the Jones family, and you're asking for the Smith family, and we bought this house from them X number of years ago, and they don't live here anymore. And I understand the process of mailing ballots out, coming back, returned undeliverable. I don't have a concern necessarily that prior family had voted, but they're still on the registration list. And this isn't intended to pick on my county clerk specifically, but is there anything else that we can do? And I've asked before, can a current homeowner or renter say, wait a minute, I've received phone calls, I've had people come to my door, I've received mail, that family doesn't live here anymore, and allow a resident to trigger a system back to the county clerk to where that verification piece of mail is sent out, something like that. Is there anything more that we could do in statute to clean up those records? Because it's frustrating for the current residents of those homes, but someone who especially who owns that home, to say in multiple election cycles, no, I've told you before, those people don't live here anymore.
Yeah, and Mike Miles' wife was not very happy when I knocked on his home for a Republican primary. So, what are you doing here? but let's do that. We'll add that as a topic for one of our others, and we'll kind of give a presentation of what we do and the reforms we've made to try to make it better. And then we can talk about, you know, does it make sense to put together a group to look at it? So we'll get a review ready to say, here's what we do, here's what we don't do, or here's what we could. Good. Elaine?
I was just going to add, I'd be interested in broadening that out to NVRA compliance more broadly, and especially the work with Drive, because I think that would help. I mean, it's not directly how can a resident get someone else's address updated, but just overall, what do list maintenance efforts look like? So hearing more about the Drive efforts and how that's all playing up. The other topic, though, that I would like to put on the table, when the COVAIM Commission was meeting, we spent a lot of time talking about making sure that WebScore was working at all of the VSPCs, and I know that the Secretary's office and the clerks have been doing a lot of work on that in the couple of years since COVAIM disbanded. One of the things, though, that I think the group had been looking for that I think was intended maybe for this group to pick up would be just an update about some of that technology and what that's looking like and some of the stress testing and load bearing and all of the kind of technology pieces that Trevor and his team were working on to make sure that we're not seeing outages or problems with voters who need to update their information or get ballots during the voting period.
Okay. Yeah, that might be one for the next meeting probably be appropriate to just give you the broad overview of what we're doing. I can definitely set that up.
Okay, good. Other topics? By the way, this isn't a speak now or forever hold your peace. If you come up with things, and, you know, the idea is we've got some things that we have seen that we know are issues. You've had those topics, but you guys also are pretty aware. Your groups, your communities are part of that.
One thing I think, this is Matt Crane, one thing I think that would be great to look at, too, as we go along is now that our system is so dependent upon the mail, if we can start looking at any issues with the USPS, any data that we have collecting, you know, in that regard, and then if there's any adjustments we need to make going forward with that, I think that'd be a great conversation too.
Okay. Good. And actually, that might really bear some fruit too. USPS takes the views of groups very seriously, and so if we as an organization come up with, you know, perspectives on, you know, the work that they do and things we want to suggest as changes, they might take those a little bit more seriously if they're coming from a group as opposed to just, you know, an agency that's complaining about them or something.
Okay. Not seeing any other hands on that issue, then let's talk about when our next
timing
meeting should be.
So I'm going to suggest that we go out maybe 2 months for this next meeting, and that'll give Elena, Deb, myself, and somebody else, Representative Neville, some chance to work on the signature review work, and I'll get together the thing that you mentioned for Trevor and for the score, web score. And we'll probably also want to try to sort of box the primary question so that we can talk about that. That'll give us a little time. So 2 months from now.
So when will we have certification as to whether it's making the ballot or not?
Literally, it will be two months from today. So wait, is it the 7th?
The
7th. Okay. So 2 months from yesterday. But we could go after that. I think maybe going after that would make sense. What important election deadlines?
You just have to tell them they made it by September
7th. By the 7th. So we'll know by the 7th what's made it, what hasn't made it. We certify 2 months from today. Is that right? I think right. We certify the ballot.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So what if we looked at the 12th?
Yeah, so maybe the following.
Does a Monday the 12th work for folks?
I think that's ballot cert date.
So technically, yes. We try to do it on the previous Friday.
Right.
We try to send it out by 5 p.m. on the previous Friday, but you're right. It deadline is the 12th. That's right. So
I don't know if that changes anything.
Well, but it might, because if we have a bad weekend, we might. and it might happen. 13? Whatever. These all work for me. 13, 14, 15. They're all fine.
Tuesday morning?
Is there regional, any regional clerks?
I don't have them on here. I have them on my calendar. I don't see any that this conflicts with.
Eastern Region's the 8th of September.
And the last week is the Southern.
So I think we're okay in that.
The West hasn't set their meeting yet, despite our many inquiries. So I think that's going to be the third week in September.
Morning of the 13th, the Tuesday morning. Does that work for folks generally?
All right. So
okay,
let's
set it.
Do that.
What time do you want to start at? I know some of you are coming from a little bit of a distance. Do we want to? So we did 9:30 to 11:30. We'll schedule it 9:30 to 12.
Sounds good.
And that way you're not in the middle of rush hour for those coming in from the hinterlands.
9:30 to 12. Okay. All right.
Judge, and
yes.
That will be here.
I don't know about which room it'll be, but it'll be at the Secretary of State's office.
And I know we're at the time frame. Is there anyone else who had anything they wanted to share or bring up? Not seeing any. We're adjourned. Thank you so much for your participation. And also, if you've got comments how you think it could be better, or if there's things you didn't like about the way we did things, let us know, and we'll at least listen.
You want more Lynn Bartles, less Judd? We can do that. We can absolutely make that happen.
By the way, for those who don't know, my Deputy Secretary of State, Suzanne Steyert, has joined us in the back. She joined us about partway through. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks, everybody.
And if anyone needs my card,
Katie, right?
Yep.
Hey, I'm Judd. Very nice to meet you. Nice America votes, you. Right?
Yep. Or wherever Carolyn Segal sends me.
Wherever. I know how that works. Thank you.